That's really what we're about tonight, is really holding up those who've had the courage and the voice to speak about the way they were abused, and then also to remember the whole church in terms of how we need to bring about healing, reconciliation, and hope. And it seems to me that if I can do one thing tonight is give you a sense of hope, is that we've been through this before. This situation is new, but the crises in the church like this are not new. So I'm going to do kind of a rapid fire run through 2,000 years of history and reform. And so if you have a safety belt, I'd put it on right now. And the oxygen mask will jump down if you happen to need it. And so we'll just go for that. I'll go for about till 8 o'clock or a little after 8, and then we'll have time for interaction, some Q&A. Okay, so if we could go to the next one, getting started here. What I'd like to do is give you, those of you who have ever worked in the Archdiocese or taken classes from me and Dennis O'Leary, will recognize what they call the Coover Grid. And it gives us kind of an analytical tool for looking at reform and the needs for what kind of reform we need. So go ahead, and again, and again, and again. So if we go to the top there, that's when everything is hunky-dory. Everything is just moving right along. 1955, we're building seminaries, we're opening convents, vocations are just pouring in. Archbishop Connolly is building one church after another in the Mahoney boxes, and it's just a flourishing of the church. Everything's kind of held together, and there's great reverence for Pius XII, although we've never seen him, but we know that if he came to our door, it'd be like Jesus knocking on our door. So everything is kind of like together. And then some things start to unwind. So go ahead and again and pause. I like to explain this model this way. It's a little simpler. Is consider a high school where it's been very traditional. And the seats are all in nice rows, and the teacher comes in and gives a nice lecture and takes polite questions and answers and so forth, interacts with the students, but it's all kind of like you are, all in neat rows and well-behaved, of course. And then there's this bright young thing of 25, young woman who comes in, and she's got a whole new way of education, and she circles all these chairs and starts to have discussions with students, and the students are loving it. They thought, this is great. And then, of course, the principal advises her, now be sure to put those desks back after the class is done. Well, of course, that doesn't happen all the time. So the traditional teacher gets upset with what's called, what we would call operational doubt. Things are kind of falling apart. So the principal, and this is typical of authority, tries to push it back to the standard, to the norm. Okay, time goes on, and the students really like this, and start asking that traditional, why can't we do that in our class? Why can't we have more discussions and get involved and do some projects like we're doing in the other class? And so then you have this clash of ways of teaching and ideology, and the traditional teacher is saying, well, that new teacher is just upsetting everything. It's just, we just can't teach this place anymore. It's just a riot in the hallways. People are talking and out of line, and it's just impossible. And we go to the next thing then. And then we start to say, he starts to question that, well, you know, there's no telling what's going to happen with that new young teacher. And look at the way she dresses. You know, so it starts to go to that level. And then time goes on, and you know, you can kind of paint the scenario itself. And you go to the next level where the traditional teacher, well, I just can't take this anymore, because now they're not only one of them, there are five of them doing this thing. And the school is just going to rack and ruin. And so now that I'm 63, I'm going to retire early. So I'm out of here. Okay, you see the model and how it moves from one level to another. Now, those of you who know the model know there are also solutions along the way, but it's not to push it back to the top, it's to go deeper into the original founding of what education is actually all about. Okay, so let's move on then. With that model in mind, we're looking at the difference between operational reform and structural reform or institutional reform. Operational reform is just going to push it back, try to restore the way it's always been. Institutional reform will move, keep moving forward into a whole new era. Okay? Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at the types of reform that happened in the early church. If you look at the first seven councils of the church, it was operational reform. In other words, the garden had gotten full of weeds. So let's pull out the weeds. Scandal and weeds must be uprooted so that we preserve the church as it's always been and cut off certain customs that have grown up that are obviously out of line, maybe some liturgical innovations. I don't think they were, they may have actually been dancing up the gifts of the altar once. You know that story, don't you, about when they first introduced procession, you know, they had this, the bishop was actually there in this one parish, the pastor was there, and they had this grand procession, and the woman was dancing up with the incense and like this, and the bishop was, as she went around the altar, the bishop leaned over to the pastor and said, "If she asks for your hand upon the platter, she's got it." You see, we have a hard time with change, but humor does help sometimes. Okay, so there's reform sometimes by accretion or addition. Some things just are added on to what's been there. But to keep untouched, what is the core or the center of it all? Okay, but there's also a sense through all these councils that there's a sense of moral decline. Now, the interesting thing about all these councils is that they're not called by the Pope, they're not called by the Patriarch, they're not even called by a local bishop. They're called by a layperson, who happens to be the emperor. So Nicaea is Constantine's villa outside of Constantinople. So that's the first council of the church is Nicaea, held in the emperor's villa. Now it's not just some nice little swell house, it's real palatial. And all those councils are held in the east. So, and the Pope just sends maybe two delegates or something like that to represent the Western Church. Okay, go ahead. Now, as you get into the medieval councils, these are the ones in the west. And it was after the Great Schism of 1054 when the Eastern and Western churches split. The first reforms in the medieval times came out of the monasteries. You had the reforms coming out of the Benedictine monastery of Cluny, where Hildebrand, who becomes Pope Gregory VII, does what we call the Gregorian Reform. And it's a reform by revival, going back to the original depth of the Gospels, and also to a more ancient legal discipline. They're addressing a number of scandals. Simony, that is buying offices, buying bishoprics, paying money in order to get benefices. Concubinage was another problem. And lay investiture. Lay investiture means that the bishops were being appointed by the emperors and the kings and the queens and so forth. They generally had that right. It was recognized up to a certain point. But there was a lot of abuse with it because the king might appoint his youngest son to the local bishopric, because in a feudal society, they acted as princes or dukes of the region. So it became kind of much more of a family affair. Now, if you think we're in tough shape and you've got a strong stomach for scandal or ears that are prickly for scandal, you might check out Benedict the Ninth. In the 10th century, probably about 1030 to 1042. He was Pope three times. He got an early start. He was only 20 when he was pushed into being Pope by his uncle, who was the previous Pope, John the 19th. And then he decided he'd kind of had enough of it. It was just a little too restrictive. So he sold the papacy to to his godfather. And then he decided, well, he's really kind of missing all the play of being a pope, and especially the dissolute life that came with it. By dissolute, we mean really outrageous sexual scandal, by the way. And so he came back again, and finally he was removed and then back again one more time for 2 years. And then finally they removed everybody and put in a pope who was leading a little more of a straight and narrow life. So that's what Hildebrand and the Gregorian, Cluniac monks were trying to reform, among other things. The papacy was really run by families in Rome. They were the ones who really had the power and the location and the votes, if you will, to and out of that comes the College of Cardinals eventually. I'll say a little bit more about that, which eventually most reforms address an issue then and then later need reforming themselves. So the College of Cardinals was a great reform because it meant then that the Pope was elected by the clergy of Rome. That's why every cardinal now has a titular church in Rome. So if you're appointed cardinal, like Lysupich in Chicago, you have a church that you're technically in charge of in Rome. Okay, because the electors for the Pope are the pastors of Rome, if you want to put it there. See how the church works in some of these strange ways. Okay, so that was the reform, though, and it was a good reform at that time, because then it removed it from all the manipulations. Well, not all of them, but some of the manipulations of the different families. Council of Constance is a really important one because there was a big attempt there to reunite the Western and Eastern churches. It came the closest to reuniting the East and the West, but it was also addressing schism in the church because you had a pope and an anti-pope. And the Council of Constance said that the council itself was superior to the pope. So you have what they call the conciliar theory. This has always been a bit of a tension ever since then, especially in the 19th century where papal infallibility becomes much more dominant. But it was very, very much aware at Vatican II that there was a time when a council said that, when a council actually said it was superior to the pope. So Vatican II kind of works out that balance in a way that Vatican I had leaned all the way in one direction, that is towards papacy. So the reform here is the reform of the church in faith and morals, in head and members. What doesn't happen so much is the head and members. This is kind of a constant. There's a call for the reform of the curia or reform of the pope, and that kind of gets slid over, and then it becomes a problem again later on, so they call another council. The very interesting thing here is that as they were addressing the issues with the Eastern Church, they said there's more than one way to express a dogma. There could be a pluralism of expressions for the same core truth. Now that was a very big breakthrough in terms of the history of the Church, and it becomes kind of a principle, a guideline of Vatican II in some ways. Okay, let's keep going here. This is a quick just run through. The Council of Trent, they called it an age of calamity. There was supposed to be the reform of the morals of clergy and Christian people. Not too much was said about the papacy itself. The popes were very reluctant to call a council. You remember that Luther had posted his theses, probably not on the door, but distributed them on 1517. It wasn't until 1543 that the Council of Trent was called by a pope much later than that, Paul III. And that went over four sessions. And they were, at that time, they were still trying to have some reunification with the Lutherans, with the German church. There was an idea of not so much reform, but of restoration. Again, it's kind of looking at going back to the way it was, the way it should be, rather than going forward. What Christ and the apostles handed on, the church has always maintained unchanged. This becomes a principle. When we were growing up in the 50s, a few of us, that was one of our prides. The church is unchanging. It's a perfect society. Societatis perfecta. We have all that we need right here in the Catholic Church. Why would we want to change? Why would we want to get out of Latin when you can go anywhere in the world and hear the Mass in the same way in Vienna as you can in downtown Seattle? There's an interesting little story in that. After they changed back into the vernacular, there's a priest visiting from China, and he said Mass at the downtown chapel in the Immaculate Conception in Boston. And he said it in Chinese. And afterwards, this Irish couple comes up to the sacristy and says, "Ah, Father, that was a wonderful Mass. It's so good to hear the Latin again." Anything you didn't understand was really wonderful. What really is a great breakthrough here is the education of clergy. For the first time, you have the establishment of seminaries. Up until this time, it was mainly just religious orders that had kind of in-depth theological education. Dominicans, of course, Franciscans somewhat, Augustinians for sure. And then, of course, this is the time when the Jesuits get started and have one of the first seminaries in Rome in 1551, the Roman College. Just a quick word, Vatican I is the least reformed of all the councils. It's drawing a moat around the church and pulling up the bridge. And there's good reason for it. It's because of the devastation of the church after the French Revolution, or during the French Revolution. And then again in 1848, when Pius IX, who had started as a somewhat liberal pope, really becomes fearful of all the revolutions that are happening in Europe. So again, they take a much more serious defensive stance on the Pope. So against religious liberty, against freedom of conscience, against freedom of the press. You name almost any positive doctrine that comes out of Vatican II and put a knot in front of it, and you have the agenda of Pius IX in the Syllabus of Errors in 1864. But you can understand that it was trying to defend the faith and especially the institution of the church during that time. Okay, let's go. Okay, so let's quickly summarize some of the key reforms. And this is to draw, to kind of glean, what are the things that we might be able to draw on today. I think that the best one is actually in the scriptures. Acts 15, you have this big dispute between the more conservative church of the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, headed by James, and then that hotbed of liberalism up there in Antioch, where Paul and Barnabas were preaching and converting the Gentiles. Now, if you look at the difference between the Gentile Christians and the Jewish Christians at that time, it's far greater than almost any of the divisions we have today, potentially anyway. So there's a delegation set up, you know, like a visitation by the center, and they go up there. But unlike the visitation in Seattle, Barnabas decides to stay there because they're doing such great work and becomes part of the ministry there in Antioch. Eventually then they come and they have to resolve this. And so there's this Council of Jerusalem, the very first council of the church. And there are two principles that I think are really important coming out of that. The first one is, do not lay an undue burden on the people. You read the text closely, they're saying, we haven't been able to keep the law, the Mosaic law, the way we're expecting the Gentiles to, so why are we expecting them to do it? Don't lay an undue burden on the people. The second is, the end of it all, after this really discernment and discussion and dialogue and argumentation, really important, they say, we and the Holy Spirit have decided. So the church itself is authorized to make the decisions it needs for the sake of the people, for the sake of the faith. When I heard this talk given by Cardinal Martini in Rome, somewhat by circumstance in Italian, he said there are three issues that every pastor knows we need to address today. This was almost 30 years ago. Divorce and remarriage, access to the Eucharist, and who gets ordained. He said, we need to come together and make decisions for the sake of the people and for the sake of the faith and authentic, and to being authentic to the gospel. Okay, now people misunderstood him a little bit. He thought they were calling for, you know, another council like Vatican II. He said, you don't need that. You know, a synod like we've had under Pope Francis would probably be more in keeping with what he thought at that time. So Council of Jerusalem, I think, is a key one. Second one is in the second and third centuries, you had already these heresies where Marcion was saying that, well, this is a whole New Testament, it's a whole new time, so we need to throw out the Jewish scriptures. So that was one thing that they had to deal with. Then there were other places that used certain letters of Paul, maybe this gospel, but not that gospel. So it became a question, what's the authentic scriptures? And there's a kind of sense of the faithful that comes out of that. And the guiding principle is, what's used more universally? What's used more Catholically, if you want to put it that way? What's more ecumenical? That is worldwide. And so that's another principle. The sense of the faithful, what's used liturgically, and does it have universal use? Does it apply, you know, somehow or other in Zambia as well as in Vienna? Another big reform, of course, is the Benedictine monasteries. You know, Anthony goes out to the desert to pray in the third century. And at that time, you might say that Anthony, young Anthony, was spiritual but not religious. Anthony was spiritual but not religious. And he's out there praying. Eventually, others come to him for spiritual direction, and he starts the monastery. And eventually, the monasteries start to flourish. And then Benedict, who's the great organizer, codifies a rule of St. Benedict. And the Benedictines really are the reforming movement through all those centuries. They've maintained the scholarship of the church, really of the whole Western civilization. And they become the centers for social works there, like the Cluny and Cistercian monasteries in the north of England. They've got pharmacies and hospitals insofar as they had it, outreach to the poor, and so forth. And then when needed, then they're called on, the monks are called upon for reform of the papacy itself. So notice the principle there that the reform often comes from the outside to the center, okay? So the Gregorian reform, I've kind of briefly covered that, and same thing. And then you have the flourishing of religious orders. Again, Francis is calling the church back to a deeper sense of the gospel poverty. And in light of the excesses and the exuberant luxuriousness of the papacy. So again, these religious orders are calling the church back to being more faithful to who we're called to be as followers of Christ. Okay, and then there's the conciliar reform. And that kind of sputters out. Remember, if you ever read that, we had three popes at one time, and eventually they're all deposed, and we get Martin V, who then is accepted by everyone, and the papacy moves from France back to Rome. We'll get into some of that. Let's skip ahead, and because I cover some of this in a later slide. We'll come back to that. Okay, there's the Council of Jerusalem, and just kind of briefly summarizing there, do not lay an undue burden on the people, and the people of God are authorized to make the decision. Okay, go ahead. And then also the census fidelium and apostolic continuity as key principles. Okay, that's the head of Constantine, by the way. There, you see it in a kind of like a back alley street outside the Bellarmino and near the Church of St. Ignatius. Okay, go ahead. And the flight to the desert, when Rome itself and the church is becoming much more powerful, they're kind of taking the place of the emperor after the fall of the West, after the fall of Rome in 476 AD. Papacy is on the ascendancy, especially in terms of actually having temporal rule. Okay, go ahead. The key thing here, it seems to me, is that what the monks and the monasteries bring is a deepening of the spirituality of the church and an articulation of that spirituality that's conserved and brought forward through the centuries. So it becomes a great resource for the whole church. Like, really, the liturgical reforms of Vatican II really come out of the Benedictine monasteries in so many ways. If you look at Virgil Michael at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, or the Salem monks in France, it's just one after the other, is that the Benedictines have this great depth of spirituality that's then broken open for the rest of the church. Okay, go ahead. These are some of the principles you can start to identify, it seems to me, that you go to the periphery. You go out to the poor, like the church in South America did after Vatican Council. You identify with people on the margins who are oppressed, like Jesus did, by the way. And then that becomes a source of reform. Now, of course, part of the problem is monasteries themselves became really wealthy and powerful. And of course, then Henry the Eighth gets a little greedy and strips the monasteries of everything. It's really sad when you go to northern England and see all these wonderful Cistercian abbeys that were destroyed. And in the process, destroyed the social fabric, because they were the outreach for the poor and the sick and people that couldn't make it on their own. And then, of course, he distributed that to his henchmen followers. Go ahead. Okay, if you ever get to France, go to Avignon. Palais de Pape, the Palace of the Pope, is just a wonderful architectural center. And then, of course, you're going to want to dance on the bridge, right? Sur les ponts d'Avignon, sur les ponts d'Avignon. Okay, so, but about the only thing left from that is the bridge, the palace, and the scandal. A lot of the reforms center around reform of power. Not a big surprise, but one of the constants throughout all these reforms is the reform of power, and where's the power center? So like when you have Francis living the gospel like he does, well then that calls into question the arbitrary use of power for one's own self-gratification. All right, go ahead. The Renaissance and Protestant reform, that's almost too big for us to cover. I mean, there's so much that happens all at once. It's like a burst of scholarship and learning and translation of texts. But once you translate the Bible into the vernacular, things start to happen. People start to read the scriptures. And that's one of the big things that happens here. In addition, is the encounter of the West with the Islam scholars. The great scholastic center prior to this time was Baghdad and southern Spain, with the Islamic scholars. And so it's the intersection of that, like with Thomas Aquinas, with Averroes, and going back to the Greek and Roman texts, especially the Greek texts, that you get the beginnings of this flourishing or flowering that happens in the Renaissance. Okay. The Council of Trent, then, contrary to the reformers, is the unchanging nature of the church. Okay. Well, that's not a bad principle. But as Newman would have said later, you've got the core of the gospel, but the way that's expressed can be a multitude of ways. And that's what Vatican II eventually recognizes, too. The Council, this is interesting. If you read John O'Malley's book on the Council of Trent, the Council itself was more open and more moderate than the way it got interpreted. In other words, it was interpreted much more severely and restricted than the Council itself had articulated. For instance, the communion was available under both species up in Germany after the Council of Trent, until they decided in Rome that, people were getting confused. The faithful were getting confused. Whenever you hear that phrase, you know that the faithful are doing just fine. But there's a power play going on. And I see Patty nodding because you've heard this. You've all heard this phrase, right? Charles Borromeo, actually St. Charles Borromeo, who was a nephew of the Pope at the time, was the one who really pushed seminary reform But he was also the one who gave the major interpretation, more restricted interpretation of Trent. Okay. If you have a chance, if you love this stuff like I do, read John O'Malley. He's got a book now on Trent, Vatican I, and then What Happened at Vatican II, which is the classic. What Happened at Vatican II by John O'Malley. You know, it's the next thing to the Gospel of Mark. Okay, go ahead. Vatican I is a lot about retrenchment, and a lot of it has to do with power and property. You know, the Pope's been jockeying for centuries to kind of keep the Papal States in touch. First, they're in alignment with the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Then they go with the French. But at the time when they moved towards the unification of Rome, from that period of about 1862, it starts in the north. And then Garibaldi breaks through the wall in Rome in 1870 and reunifies all of Italy. But that happens after the French troops have pulled out, you see, because they always have these kind of alliances in order to protect the property. So it also brought an abrupt end to Vatican I, which had two doctrines that were defined, infallibility of the Pope and the primacy of Peter. And the whole role of bishops never got defined. That was because it was abruptly finished. And so then Pius IX, who by this time was more and more conservative, aided and abetted by the Jesuits, I might say. Remember, it's the Jesuits who draft the syllabus of errors for him, and also the document on the infallibility of the Pope. You think that we've been on all sides at one time or another. But especially in the 19th century, where after the suppression of the Jesuits came back quite conservative in terms of theology, in terms of pastoral work. They were spread out all over the world. Okay, let's move along there. So what are the principles that we could pull forward? This was sort of my assignment. Do not lay an undue burden on the people. And you have this in your handout, I think. People are authorized, the people of God are authorized to make reforms. How it happens is another issue, but the Council of Jerusalem gives us a model. Bring together the heads of the church. Have a vigorous discussion, a debate, and dissension, and so forth, and then discern where the Spirit is leading this, and you come out with, we and the Spirit have decided. Now, you'll recall that when Pope Francis called the first synod on the family, he said, this is going to be a difficult synod. Remember, I don't have all the answers, so feel free to disagree with me. We need a dialogue that's vigorous and do a discernment. That's the nature of discernment, and it's going to get messy. Discernment is messy, he'd say, and it's going to have a lot of different opinions. Well, the Bishop of Providence, Rhode Island, was not too happy with all this. And in a blog he writes, and I need to interpretate him a little bit, in a blog he writes, well, the Pope has called this synod. It reminds me very much of a Protestant gathering, because they're having this voting all the time. Everything is being voted on. And the Pope has said, this is going to get messy. Discernment's going to get messy. Well, I would say, mission accomplished. But but it does capture a sense of discernment takes time, and it takes patience, and it takes deep listening to what we're not always, especially as Americans, maybe we're not so keen on. I've been to international meetings with the Spaniards and Italians, and Americans just go like, oh my God, will they ever finish? Because there's a different style, there's a different culture. In Spanish, you have to create a whole world before you can insert your clear idea. And from a Spanish point of view, they say, well, these Anglo-Saxons are so abrupt and rude. They just get right to the point. You see, so discernment internationally is going to take some cultural awareness and education, frankly. Okay. The census fidelium, that's a real big one that Pope Francis keeps mentioning, is the sense of the faithful has been way underplayed after 1870. Really, it's what I call grandmother certitudes, right? Grandmothers know the faith. They may not articulate it, but they know the faith. They know that, you know, their daughter struggled with this, and she already had five children. So birth control, I mean, that doesn't make any sense, right? It's a teaching that really has not been received by the faithful. Now, there are all kinds of reasons. It's a beautiful document, Humani Vitae and so forth, and some people are able to observe it. Great. But not necessarily a universal teaching. That's just one example. What's the sense of the faithful? What's actually received in faith by the people? And there's kind of like a dialogue between authoritative teaching and not a consensus, we're not voting on this, but it's a deeper sense of the faithful. There may be only one person who can articulate it in a group like this, but then you'll say, ah, that's it. That's what we believe. The universality is another key mark of authenticity. Go to the periphery for reform. This was actually interesting when the Jesuits met for its general congregation in Rome and in 2006. Benedict was the Pope, and he addressed the Jesuits and he said, the Jesuits have always been on the frontier. Where the church is not, the Jesuits need to go. And so you need to respond to your history. You have a distinguished history. And the examples of Matteo Ricci in China and John DiNobili in India and the Paraguay reductions are great examples of Jesuit initiative and going to the frontiers. You need to go to the frontiers and remain connected with the center. I mean, it was good the way you put that. You have to live that tension. So Benedict was a great scholar. So he got it. He got what are probably one of the best folks of getting what our charism was about as Jesuits. But I think also, it's not just Jesuits. If you look at the history of religious orders, that's where they, a lot of times they are. Anthony out in the desert, Francis up in Assisi with that great spirituality center. If you ever have a chance to get to Assisi, it's just, I don't know, it's just soul nourishing just to walk up the hills there. There needs to be a kind of a continuous spiritual renewal in the church. And a lot of times those in power have a tough time with that, with some rare exceptions. Every once in a while, like someone said, wouldn't it be great, this was said at a conference at CLU, 1986, wouldn't it be great if there was just one saint on the West Coast? And he meant Archbishop Huntas. He didn't say it, but that's what he meant. I've mentioned the charism of monasticism. There are lay movements in the church today who have taken that monastic tradition and adapted it into a more secular world, using liturgy the hours in a more modified way. But there's a great wealth to be drawn upon there by all of us, especially this is the age of the laity, but draw on the tradition, because this came out of lay movements. The religious orders are all lay movements to start with, and then they get sacerdotalized. Okay, but they're lay movements to start with. The spiritual regeneration then renews the center. That's kind of an ongoing theme throughout all this. Now, a couple of cautions, and one is that one reform leads to the need to be reformed itself. So you reform the whole thing around the appointment of bishops and put in the College of Cardinals and having the Pope appoint all the bishops. But then that becomes a problem itself, okay? That needs ongoing reform. And the other thing is that rapid change can paralyze the church. And then when that happens, when there's a lot of anxiety in any culture, you tend then to move towards, well, who's going to save us from this chaos? Well, Napoleon, of course, a dictator, someone who can bring order back into and give us a sense of security. Even if we give up a little freedom, we need that safety and freedom from anxiety. Huh? So that's another dynamic that plays here when you're moving towards, you know, especially if things get messy in discernment, you're saying, well, can he just decide? Well, that's not really what we're called to as a people of God. It gets a little messy on the way. The early Christians were not called Christians, by the way, until, you know, except up there in that hotbed of liberalism in Antioch. They were called people of the way. We were on the way. Hadas in Greek. So and it was great because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the light. And so as followers of Christ, we were people of the way. And that has a certain, that's what is captured in the people of God. We're people on a pilgrimage with all the turmoil that sometimes goes with that, rather than a perfect society that has it all together. Okay, let's see what we got. So here's some of the reforms of Francis. He really is implementing the trajectories of Vatican II. He doesn't argue about whether it's in continuity or discontinuity with the past like Benedict did in kind of a very scholarly way. He just assumes Vatican II is our benchmark. He's the first pope educated in theology after the council, because he's ordained in 1969. And so he's really embodies the teaching of the council as it came forth at that time. The other recent popes were all in the council. Now, I don't know about you, sometimes I found myself in meetings and I don't find out about what really went on until the party a week later when people start talking about it. Because I have only a slice of it. So if you're in a big meeting like that, you don't necessarily know everything that's going on. I tell my students sometimes, we know more about the Treaty of Westphalia than the people there did. And they look at me kind of strangely, oh, he's flipped again. You know, but you could know it if you studied it. That's 1648, brought the end of the 30 Years' War, and so forth. So Francis just assumes the trajectories of the council. The other thing is that Benedict always had this tension, really, and kind of dismissed national conferences of bishops as not having authority unless you had, in other words, they didn't have a teaching authority unless you had 100% of the bishops supporting the vote. Well, that's, you know, you look at the, whatever we have, 190 ordinaries, and that's never going to happen. So, but Francis doesn't get into that argument. But when he writes his encyclicals, he quotes National Conferences of Bishops authoritatively. In his Joy of the Gospel encyclical, he quotes 23 times National Conferences of Bishops, including the United States, the Philippines, Latin America, and so forth. So it's like they have teaching authority, and I'm going to use that as part of my teaching authority. See? It's not an argument. I don't think he's even talked about that. He just does it. The other part, and this is maybe the biggest thing, is their end of monarchy. You know, they tried to put the red slippers on him after he was elected pope. And he said, well, these old shoes fit pretty well. I think I'll just keep these. Well, might have to polish them a little bit. And then he comes out on the balcony and I found it very moving. Bon air. And then he asked everybody to pray for him. And that evening that we were all expected for. Now the problem was and actually he's not the first one to start to dismantle monarchy. It really starts with John XXIII, and then especially Paul VI, who gives his tiara to the poor in Brazil. And then it's ended up in some museum after someone bought it, I think. I don't know where it is right now. But you used to have a coronation of the Pope, too. We no longer have a coronation, we have an installation. So the last coronation we really had was maybe John XXIII, but the one was the coronation of Pius XII in March 2nd, 1939. So it was like a coronation of a king, right? That was kind of the idea, with kind of the triple tiara, you know, like Okay. But in the Catholic Church, once you change symbolic structures, you start changing how people express their faith. You know, just think of your time as a Catholic, or especially after Vatican II. You change the altar around. You say, well, that's just changing the table setting. Oh, I don't think so. The priest turns around, faces the people, and says, woo! Real people out there. And then it's in the vernacular. People start critiquing your homilies in a little different way, because now they understand everything that you're saying, and they've read the gospel, and they understand the gospel. And so these changes start to happen rather quickly, those 10 years right after Vatican II. But it's not just symbolic change. The symbols change. The shifting of symbols really goes much deeper than just the surface. One of the things that Francis addressed even before he was elected as Pope, they have the congregation of cardinals where they all sit around and they each have 5 minutes. Even those who are retired have 5 minutes to say, what does the church need today? And it's a long listening session, kind of discernment. And at that time, Francis said, the church is too self-centered, too narcissistic, too concerned about itself, and way too clerical. And then he said, Christ is knocking on the door of the church, but he's knocking from the inside trying to get out. And then they elected him. Well, I don't think they quite realized what they were getting. I think they were looking at especially maybe three things. One was reform of the Vatican Bank and the finances. Two is reform of the Roman Curia, because a lot of local cardinals were fed up with the way they were being treated by the dicasteries or the cabinets in Rome. So those were certainly two key things. But then when Cardinal Pell, who has his own issues, came into Rome to start to reform the Vatican Bank, he also started to look at the budgets for all the cabinets. Well, that's not part of the plan. And so then he starts discovering all these irregularities where someone, the cardinal in charge of the propagation of the faith, that is for really the poor regions of the country, had taken 160,000 euro to remodel his apartment. So all these financial irregularities start to surface because now there's a greater transparency, and that becomes the norm. Now that's going to take a while to get that done, and now we have to find someone else with that kind of moxie as a financier. The overriding thing I think that Francis brings is a sense of the compassion of Jesus and the centrality of mercy in the church. His first year as Pope, he called it for a year of mercy. Now this is not new, because 1 John the 23rd designated the first Sunday after Easter as the church as divine mercy. So what they're doing always is drawing forth the riches of the church for what the people need today. It's what they did in Vatican II in the aggiornamento, the updating, was to use ressourcement, which is a good French term, to go back to the resources of the church, the ressourcement, and to pull forward all the richness that we've experienced through all these different decades. And so our second canon of the Mass really is revival of Hippolytus in the 3rd century. So you see how that, and you said, well, then you have to translate a little better than what we have now. That's a whole nother topic. We really don't have an English translation right now. We have a kind of a botched Latinate one. And then with an overlay of a certain ideology around earning or meriting grace, which is, you know, the second canon is, I hate to break this to you, but the second canon is heretical. It really is. That we might merit to become co-heirs with Christ. So, I mean, you might want to let your pastor know about that. there's kind of a seriousness to that. Because as the baptism of the faithful, you have an obligation to help correct the church, the priesthood of the faithful. That's also articulated in Vatican II, by the way. It's not exactly preached from the pulpit, however. is that we as a people have the authority we need to make the changes we need for the authenticity and the living out of the gospel today. Now, this image is one that's a favorite of Pope Francis. He used it in his first interview when the editor of Civiltà Cattolica, Antonio Spadaro, was interviewing him over in Casa Maria. And the first question Antonio asks is, "Who are you?" And then there's this long silence, and Antonio, I can tell, gets sort of nervous. He said, "Is that okay to ask you that?" And he said, the Pope says, "Yeah, that's fine. I'm thinking, I'm trying to recall it." He said, "Well, first of all, I'm a sinner, and that's not just rhetoric. When I was provincial in Argentina, I was too authoritarian, did too much on my own. I didn't consult enough. I didn't discern what really needed to be. I thought I had it together myself, and so I made a lot of decisions that were harmful to people. So I'm a sinner, but I'm a forgiven sinner. I've been shown God's mercy and forgiven." And that, so a forgiven sinner is central to his experience, not just his belief, but his experience. And then he says to Antonio, he said, "Remember that painting by Caravaggio over in San Luigi Francese? And it's Jesus, you can see the figure of light, pointing to Matthew, the calling of Matthew." And he said, "In that painting, I'm Matthew. I'm kind of clutching to who I am as Jesus reaches out to touch me with divine mercy." And it captures beautifully the experience, not only of Pope Francis, but of what we're all invited to as people of God, that we've made mistakes, we've stumbled, we've hurt people, and yet we've been shown mercy constantly and called to compassion and showing that to others then too. Okay, let's go ahead. So, going way back to difference between operational reform and institutional reform, what could we expect this year? Well, operational reform would be, frankly, it seems much deeper, but really effectively addressing the sexual abuse crisis in the church is really on that operational level. Now, it's going to make it last, it's going to take some structural change. Reform of the Vatican Curia. That's going to happen. There's going to be a new document coming up called, which will replace the structure of the Curia that was established by John Paul II in Pastor Bonus. And the new document will be called To Preach the Gospel. So that's underway. Those are a few things like that. That are, and of course, the reform of the Vatican Bank, things like that. Transparency in the all the other accounts. Those are really just good practice, good operational reforms. For institutional reforms, well, let's start with ordination of women as deacons. I think if we weren't all caught up right now in the sexual abuse crisis, that would be moving forward with some rapidity. Now, the Pope has appointed a commission to study that, and it's not just your typical commission, it's really savvy people. I was quite encouraged when I saw that Phyllis Zagano was appointed to that, because she's the outstanding church historian commentator on women deacons in the early church. I mean, she really has got strong arguments on that, and documentation, especially through frescoes and artwork, and showing through text too, that the ordination rite of women as deacons was exactly the same as ordination of men as deacons. I've got a canon lawyer here, so I could refer to Bev if I need to. The seems to be another one coming up this fall. Well, could be the, in terms of institutional reform, the Synod of Bishops in the Amazon. I don't know if you're aware that that's going to happen. They're looking at a number of things. They're looking at the ecological devastation of the earth and of the forest, and the impact of that on the poor. But they're also responding to access to the Eucharist. About 4 years ago, not too long after Francis was elected, one of the bishops way out there in the outlying areas of the Amazon came to the Pope and said, you know, I don't have the exact numbers, I have 15 priests for 128 missions and parishes. There's no way I can serve all these parishes and missions and have Eucharist available to the people. Isn't there some way we could ordain men for these villages or for these tribes out there in the Amazon? And the Pope didn't say no, that's not our. He said, well, you need to talk about that in your conference, in your national conference, and then bring it to me and bring it to us for further consideration. So the phrase used is very probati, not qualified men, not outstanding men, but men of virtue would be maybe, or yeah. So it doesn't translate too easily into English, but it's not approved men. That is more than that. It's for of good character, men of good character. Now, that would have a lot of impact, potentially. For instance, just right here in the United States, we have the Jesuits have been involved with the Inuit people up in Alaska for years, and there are a whole string of parishes now of deacons. But the priests might come there only once every 2 months or so. Well, those deacons could be ordained basically tomorrow, because they're really the leaders of the parish. But it's interesting, one of the Jesuits said, but that would be a mistake. Because if you just did it the way we've always done it, because there are other charisms in the parish. For instance, women are much better at caring for the dead and for the sick and the dying, and even anointing people when they are dying, than the deacons would be. So if you sacerdotalize everything again, you collapse the charisms of the church. So would it make more sense to ordain or recognize or institute or maybe have other kinds of ministries that are recognized? Certainly here you to the women deacons would be a natural. You see, so it's not an easy issue just to start ordaining because there's a lack of it of Eucharist. You have to go deeper, I think, into what's actually needed. Okay, I think that's it. Here's the kind of overall summary. Elements for structural reform that are needed, huh? Francis is real big on local synods. He said, we can learn a lot from the Eastern Church. You know, the Eastern Church has 16 patriarchies. And they make decisions much more regionally. Like there's the Romanian Orthodox Church, there's the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Russian Orthodox. Of course, there are conflicts among them sometimes, too. It's not all hunky-dory, because they can't go forward and make a unified decision until all 16 patriarchs agree on something. And sometimes they won't even come to the meeting. So they haven't had kind of like a high-level, what we would call a council ever, for over 100 years. Okay, so end of clericalism, that would help a lot. Maybe just one example is how our priests are trained. Wouldn't it make more sense to have priests and laity trained together, yes, rather than having seminarians going off into somewhat rural areas often enough, having completely separate training, different culture, lay people having same degrees but at a university or a major center. And then at the end of it all, you say, okay, now work together. You see, so if there was a better recognition of all the charism of the church, it'd be go a long ways towards ending clerical privilege. Leadership of women in the church, that's going to be a long struggle. And the church is just starting, really, as a larger institution. Of course, you could say, well, I don't know what your experience was, but it was the women in the church that ran that trained me when I was growing up. I mean, the nuns were the ones who carried the faith, especially after the French Revolution. I mean, you look at what the sisters have done in the United States, and it's a gift to all of us, especially in the United States, I would say. So we can learn a lot from the experiences of women already. We need to listen more deeply to women's experiences and what they can bring forward, and not just to make decisions about ordination of women by men. Okay, I'm preaching there, but I think it's needed. A deep-seated financial transparency will help a lot. I think the next scandal, frankly, after the sexual abuse, will be the financial scandals. Now, there are plenty of them out there, but they haven't all surfaced. A few of them have surfaced. I think there's more. If we shifted, this is where, this would be a significant change, especially in the United States, where the bishop is the sole corporation. That means the bishop has control over all the finances. He does need to consult on finances with his finance counsel to make a decision. But that's one of the reasons why the legal issues around sexual abuse have been so virulent. In the early stages of the United States, Bishop John England in South Carolina, which included North Carolina and part of Georgia at that time, instituted lay trusteeship. So the parishes were owned by lay trustees. And the laity had some say in who was named as pastor to that parish. Okay, you say, so that all got switched, especially by Irish bishops later on. But there was a group of kind of like what I would call American bishops who were looking for an indigenous American experience of Catholicism. It'd be like Archbishop John Ireland in St. Paul, Minnesota, was really arguing early on for the Mass in English. He actually celebrated Mass in English at different times. He refused to have the Jesuits come to his parish because they were so Roman and so conservative. That's why we don't have any major institutions in the Twin Cities. Until much later, we have a retreat house. But he wisely kept us out of there. And then some kind of more modified way of appointing bishops. This is a kind of a constant in the church, as you've seen, but we need to have a greater impact of the laity in terms of the bishops that are appointed more regionally. But it doesn't mean that they wouldn't be approved finally by the Pope, but there are other models that we could use. The very first bishop in the United States, John Carroll, was elected by the clergy and then approved by the Pope. So now that we had only about 25 or 26 priests in the United States at that time, it was a very Protestant country, and almost all of them were Jesuits, or former Jesuits rather. Remember, the Jesuits had been suppressed by the Pope in 1773, and that's a lecture you can hear some other time. Okay, so that's it. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share this with you.